our hearts. Be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, liturgically, the fourth Sunday in Lent is often called Laetare Sunday, which is an imperative Latin verb meaning to rejoice. The reason being is that the traditional introit, or the song sung before worship for the fourth Sunday in Lent, is rooted in Isaiah 66, beginning in verse 10, which begins, "Rejoice for Jerusalem." And several verses of comforting, encouraging words about the Lord's intention to restore Jerusalem. And this fits perfectly with our psalm that we chanted earlier, Psalm 122. "I was glad when they said to me, 'Let us go to the house of the Lord.' Now our feet are standing within your gates, O Jerusalem." And so there's hope of restoration for what has been damaged. Our Old Testament reading from 2 Chronicles narrates the fall of Jerusalem, the beginning of the exile. There's hope for that which has been damaged, hope for that which has been put away. On this fourth Sunday in Lent, we often think in terms of refreshment. In fact, in England, this Sunday is often called Mothering Sunday, so the British Mother's Day. So if you're an expat, happy Mother's Day to you. But also Refreshment Sunday. The reason being is because of the gospel text that we've heard today. And before the three-year cycle of lectionary readings in the late 60s came into being in Anglican churches, on the fourth Sunday in Lent, John 6, the text we heard today, was always the gospel, Refreshment Sunday. Now, in literature, there's no better image of refreshment than Tolkien's Rivendell. If you've read The Lord of the Rings, you're familiar with Rivendell. In the Silmarillion, Tolkien describes Rivendell as a place of refuge for the weary and for the oppressed, a place where there's good counsel and deep lore. You remember in The Fellowship of the Ring, Frodo has just been almost fatally wounded, and he wakes up and discovers that he's at Rivendell, where the elves are practicing their healing arts, bringing him back. Not only to consciousness, but to new strength to prepare him for the journey ahead. And so on the fourth Sunday in Lent, as we've been walking with Jesus, the way of the cross, the way to Jerusalem, we pick up our heads and we look and we see that Easter Day is closer now than it was when we started this journey on Ash Wednesday. And so the custom of the church is to encourage people to even lighten up on their Lenten disciplines on the fourth Sunday in Lent as a reminder that we're being refreshed, we're being renewed, that there's hope for that which has been broken. So let's reflect on John 6, 1 to 15. Now, on John 6 in its entirety, we could spend a whole year of sermons. John 6, 1 to 15, we could probably spend 10 weeks of sermons, but I'm only going to give one today. So come back over the coming years and you'll hear some more. The feeding of the 5,000 is the only miracle in the ministry of Jesus, his ministry proper, which is narrated by all four of the Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all talk about this miracle that Jesus does in the wilderness for the people who are hungry. So this is a central story in the identity of early Christians. And you know that the Gospel of John, not structured as much chronologically, but it's structured around a series of signs. This is the word that John uses. And then there's always a meditation or a theological reflection on the sign. And so the sign here, of course, in John 6 is the feeding of the 5,000. In the context, it's important. Jesus has been healing. He's been doing all of these miracles, and there's a great crowd that's following him. He's up in Galilee. He goes to the other side of the lake, and there's a great crowd that's following him. And so Jesus has to go up on the mountain with his disciples, not to get away from the crowds, but to create at least a little bit of space between him and the crowds. But then John throws in this line. "Now the Passover of the Jews was near." And just parenthetically, we believe that Jesus did his ministry for 3 years. And the reason being is that in John's gospel, we read about three separate Passovers. The first, which we heard about last week when Jesus cleansed the temple in Jerusalem, and then this one, and then finally his final Passover. And so in doing so, John, who does nothing by accident, is calling his reader to the Passover. He's setting in mind the events of the Passover, which, of course, was a celebration, the remembrance of God delivering his people from slavery in Egypt into freedom. And so it's in our mind. The Passover is near. The Passover is coming. And here they are, the people in the wilderness. And Old Testament readers think about the wilderness regularly because, of course, after the Exodus, there wasn't immediate entry into the Promised Land, but rather 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And the experience of the Israelites in the wilderness included a miraculous supply of food. They were complaining, let's go back to Egypt, the food was better there. And God provides for them manna in the wilderness. Manna is a Hebrew word that literally means, what is it? Because it was so unfamiliar looking. But it sustained them through the wilderness journey. God gave bread from heaven. This became an important part of Israel's story. In the Psalms, we often hear the psalmist remind the people, he gave us bread from heaven to eat. And so the stage is set then. Our mind is set to Passover. We're in the wilderness. And Jesus looks at the crowd and then he grabs his friend Philip, who, remember, in John 1 was one of the first disciples to be called. He said, what are we going to do with all these people? They're probably pretty hungry. And Philip said, I don't know what to do. And John, in parentheses, he wants to be really clear that Jesus actually knew what he was going to do. It's not that Jesus was ignorant. Jesus knew what was going to go on. And then Andrew, who was also one of the first disciples called from John 1, who Andrew has this habit of bringing people to Jesus all the time. John 1, he's bringing Peter to Jesus to meet him. I met this man. I think he's the Messiah. And now he's bringing this little boy. Well, this little boy, he has some loaves, barley loaves. He has a couple fish. But I don't know how this is going to help. And then Jesus says, okay, well, let's have everybody sit down. We'll see what happens. And then we read that Jesus gave thanks, the Greek word for Eucharist, gave thanks, and he distributed the bread. Now, readers of John's gospel will immediately flash forward to the Last Supper. It's the same language that's being used. But John is the only gospel that does not have a narrative of the Last Supper. And scholars have often scratched their heads about this. When John narrates the last night of Jesus' life, he talks about the foot washing and then the beautiful teaching that Jesus gives between John 14 and 17, but there's no institution of the Eucharist. And so a lot of scholars have said, well, here it is, folks. This is John's way of communicating the centrality of the Eucharist to the experience of a Christian, that Jesus gives thanks, the Greek word for Eucharist, and then he distributes the bread to each person who is there. And we're left to conclude that Jesus actually distributed the bread to all the people that were there. In the synoptic accounts, however, the disciples are the ones doing the distributing, and you can actually do a both and there if you try hard enough. But all that to say that Jesus is the one that's distributing this bread. And then we discover that this isn't just ordinary bread. To use another Tolkien image, this is like the lembas bread that you get at Rivendell. And the lembas bread is the kind of proto-superfood. And this is bread that will keep you going for weeks and weeks, and it stays fresh for months and months as long as you keep it covered with these special leaves. And so back to this place of refreshment, and back to this place of being satisfied. So we get to this place where after people have eaten, we read they were satisfied. They were satisfied. How many of us, day to day, can say that we're satisfied? How many of us have any experience in our life and say we're satisfied? But Jesus and the bread that he brings us results in being satisfied. And I think Jesus is going to reflect on this later in John chapter 6. And by the way, the rest of John chapter 6 will show up in the lectionary in August. So if you're away for the summer, I'm sorry about that. But we will deal with this, the rest of John 6 in August, where Jesus reflects on this bread. And then he identifies himself as the true bread. And then he says, your ancestors ate bread and manna in the wilderness, but they hungered again. But then Jesus says, I am the bread of life. And so we find that it is Jesus and the bread that he brings that ultimately satisfies. And how many of us, day to day, are seeking satisfaction in all the wrong places. For many, we say, well, once I make this amount of money, or once I get this amount of career success, or once I get to this place in my family, once I have kids, once my kids leave the house, once I retire, once we pay off the house, then we'll be satisfied. But to quote Angelica Schuyler and Alexander Hamilton, if you've listened to the soundtrack, I'll never be satisfied, they say. But here we have 5,000 who were satisfied. Why? It's because they were in the right place, seeking the right thing at the right time from the right person. It's Jesus that satisfies. So after they're satisfied, they pick up 12 baskets. You know, was it one for each disciple? Who knows? A lot of people have tried to have fun with why there are 12 and why John cared to say that it was 12. But then you have two reactions. Reaction one, this is the prophet who's to come into the world. Now, this harkens back to Deuteronomy chapter 18, 15, when Moses told the people of Israel that there will be a prophet like me. And when he comes, listen to him. And so this idea of a prophet like Moses fused with the Jewish messianic expectation. And so the prophet was understood to be a messianic character. And because Jesus was able to multiply bread, remember, the ancestors ate the bread from heaven given by God. Jesus is now giving us bread. Maybe there's an identification between Jesus and God. This is the prophet who is to come into the world. Because of Jesus' action, there is faith, response of faith in him. But then Jesus responds differently. He understands that because he's done this work, people are going to believe that he is, in fact, the Messiah, which, of course, he is. But what he doesn't want is for them to seize him and sit him on the throne and make him the king. Because that's what they'll be tempted to do. There was this longing. The satisfaction narrative of a first century Jew definitely included that when the Messiah is in Jerusalem and seated on the throne, then I'll be satisfied. And here he is, bread from heaven, feeding, satisfying. Let's make him the king. Let's seize him and sit him on the throne. Flash forward, John chapter 19. Jesus is seized, but not by the Jews, by the Romans. Jesus is not sat on a throne, but put on a cross. And this, ultimately, is how Jesus becomes king. Jesus is glorified on the cross in the resurrection. And it's through the cross and through the resurrection that Jesus begins to bring in the new creation, which John, who's also the author of Revelation, identifies and describes as the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven. And so we're back where we started, longing for the restoration of Jerusalem. It's not the Jerusalem of the first century, not the Jerusalem of David and Solomon in the 10th and 9th century BC, certainly not the war-torn, conflict-ridden Jerusalem of today, but the new Jerusalem that comes out of heaven, John in Revelation says. And all the nations stream to its light, and the Lamb that was slain is on the throne in the center of the new Jerusalem. There's no temple there. We don't need the sun because the brightness of the Lamb illuminates everything. And all, again, all the nations, bringing all of the goodness and all of the beauty, are streaming to the new Jerusalem. But the new Jerusalem doesn't happen until Jesus is seized and put on the cross. That's how Jesus becomes king. And that's what they didn't know in John chapter 6. So here's an image for Lent 4, and maybe even for Christian life, that we are pilgrims. We understand ourselves as pilgrims en route to the New Jerusalem. Now, Lent is especially a season where we lean in, where we're mindful of our sin, we're mindful of our inner wounds, we're mindful of the brokenness of the world. And we do things like fast, and we do things like give alms, and we do things like make confessions. But today, we're reminded that there's hope of restoration, that we lift our head up, and we see in the distance the New Jerusalem. Now, tomorrow, we're going to get back down, because there's a lot to do between now and Easter Sunday. There's a lot of journey to walk with Jesus between now and then. But just for today, we lift up our heads and we see what's coming. And we're filled with hope. And as the Lord invites each one of us to gather around his table this morning, he gives us himself. It's not as though Jesus is sitting in the New Jerusalem and he's sending us postcards from time to time to encourage us. It's as though Jesus is sitting in the New Jerusalem and mysteriously, mystically, he gives us himself as we walk the way that leads to that place. And so he calls us around his table and he gives us himself. And so this morning, be refreshed. Be renewed, be filled with the hope that comes from the knowledge that that which is broken, that that which is destroyed is being put back together by the one who was seized and put on the cross. Amen.